Okay, so the server-side header is taking advantage of work on the client-side header. On the client side, for any given stub, there are two things coming around. One is a single sheet, textconsole.server.h, and the other is textconsole.c. On the client side, for any given client call, you know that you're sending one message. You know that you're getting back one message, or possibly a single word exception code. So those aren't too hard to generate. The problem on the server side is you don't know what request you're going to get. Furthermore, you don't know which interface you're going to get that request on. So there's some set of interfaces that you implement, and you need, in effect, a grand union of all of the possible incoming messages that you might get. You furthermore need a second grand union for all the possible replies that you might send corresponding to those messages. So on the client side, things are pretty simple. On the server side, you have this grand union, and then you have this little demultiplexing exercise. So what you see in textconsole.server.h, the IDL IF union, right? This is the union of all inter... Whoops, what am I saying? Okay. Two kinds of procedures get emitted into one of these files. One is the demarshalling procedure. It's the one that takes the byte sequence, which is the message that comes out of the kernel, and turns it back into things like integers and structures. And then it makes a call to a handler procedure, which it declares but does not define. So if you look at line 18, there's a declaration of a procedure, handle, Kyoto's driver, text console, clear. Defining that procedure is your job. But that's the implementation of the clear method. And then there is a demarshalling bit of code which knows how to decode that message and re-encode its reply. And you'll see this handler demarshaller pattern again and again. And then if you get down to line 126, you'll see there's a union. This is a union of all of the methods that are part of the Kyoto's driver text console interface. Notice those include the ones that it inherited from CAP. Okay, and then the next thing you'll see, it got away with this because this is the interface you use. So what the heck's going on? I know what's going on. Each interface, you will see one of these unions for that interface. Then you'll see a dispatcher that knows how to dispatch the methods that are part of that interface. And what it basically does is it switches on the opcode, right, and then calls the appropriate demarshalling routine, passing it a pointer to the appropriate handler function, one that you hopefully implement. Now, there's a method to the madness here. If you look closely, you'll see that all of the demarshalers are declared static inline, which means they ought to get expanded in place into that switch statement. We probably ought to make that a little more configurable than it is right now. And then the handler functions, they have this IDL server handler predecl, which, unless you do something else with it, is defined to empty, and in which case that becomes a forward declaration. You can put your handler wherever you want. But if you have a handler that's just a couple of instructions, you might well want to choose to inline it, and you can do that there if you choose to do so. The problem with all this dispatching stuff is you end up doing three layers of procedure calls to get to the handler, which you'd sort of like to take out where that turns out to be possible. If you flip over to textconsole.c, line 72, you'll see the grand server union. So this is simply a union of all of the interfaces you're going to deal with. Plus, a generic structure for the generic parameter block, because there are occasions where you want to manipulate that, plus a generic structure for exceptions, because it turns out all exception messages have the same layout. And then it's convenient to be able to extract the control word to do some sanity checking, so that's in that union as well. That union, in fact, this whole file was generated by Capital. So if you were to do a make dist clean, take the whole tree, down into the driver text console directory, do a make clean there. That will only clean that one directory. And then do a make. You will get to see it run Capital, and you will get to see it produce the server dispatch file. If you make clean there, you will only see the server dispatch file. watch the capital command line. You'll see it has a dash S somewhere in the command line, meaning I want the server header. If you change that dash S to a dash T, what it will generate is a template file. In fact, if I can just quickly do that. Well, maybe that wasn't such a clever strategy. There you go. Okay. So you see this capital line. Okay. Let me rerun that. I'm just going to substitute dash S for dash T. Because you're anticipating the project that I've been promising, you're looking at this saying, holy crud, I got to do all this yucky stuff. The answer is, it's not quite as bad as it could be. It's almost that bad. Okay, so. Okay, notice this thing template.c. That is the default name that Capital will use to issue the template file if you don't tell it dash O something. And if we were to look at that template, and that template will have built into it code to dispatch any interface, any IDL file that you specify on the command line, it will assume that your server is implementing that interface. As long as you get all of them listed, you're okay. Unfortunately, if you later decide to add an interface, you may have to tweak the file by hand. At that point, my recommendation is generate a new template file, but then hand merge its differences into your file. But the IDL grant server union is done for you, more or less. There's a stub function, choose IF, so let me explain that. On the server side, Rick, we know all of the methods you might implement, but we don't know what objects they go with. The transport layer, we got a message in on a particular endpoint ID with a particular protected payload. We got to get that associated to an interface so that we can demultiplex the message. But the association between those things and the interface is something that only you, the programmer, know. So the mechanism relies on you implementing this choose IF. It tells you the endpoint ID and the protected payload. You tell it the interface ID, and then it switches on that. All right, it generated the server environment structure. It generated at least a start at a process requests procedure. Occasionally, you'll find that there's a piece of that or two you have to tinker with, but we've been lucky so far. It did not generate main. It did not generate an initialize call. It has no idea what you want to do in your initialize, right? Probably it should have generated an empty initialize routine in a sort of prototypical main procedure. Certainly wouldn't hurt it. But you can see that the sort of critical stuff is actually here already. And what you're mostly left to do is implement the handle procedures. We were trying to get at least as close to that as we could automate. And I don't think we got all the way as far as we could have, but we got close. So if you were to take, let me just show that command line again. All right, how to reproduce this? Go to the text console directory. Build the whole tree. Go to the text console directory. Driver text console. Make clean, make all. I'll show you the capital line and then change the dash S to a dash T. And if you compare that template.c to text console.c, in this particular case, you'll see a fair bit of evolution because of the way the text console got edited. But you'll be able to see that there's a very clear relationship, and there's a lot of boilerplate, even now, in text console.c that came pretty much straight out of template.c. And it's all of the ugly boilerplate, I hope. So what's left? Well, is the actual logic of text console. So if you were to look at, you know, starting at roughly line 100, well, even line 95, right, you'll see it's starting to do enumerations, and it's doing declarations for things like knowing what's a printable character, and knowing how to talk to the frame buffer. All this is stuff that has nothing to do with interface dispatch. It has to do with being a console. It's got a thoroughly half-assed VT52 emulator. We have a better one. It hasn't been integrated. And then process input is a procedure that basically takes a character you wanted to print, turns it into whatever word it is we're actually going to put on the display. And then starting at 667, you see some handle procedures, and you can see that these handle procedures tend to be terribly exciting. Generally one line apiece. Get type, really exciting. We actually could have emitted those probably automatically. The reason we didn't, by the way, is that, maybe I'll change the template generator. Okay, clear is currently not implemented, which is moderately embarrassing. It should simply call the clear routine. But you can see that PutChar is doing approximately what you'd expect. It's taking in one character and basically turning to the terminal logic and saying, process this character as input. And PutCharacterSequence is just doing that over a sequence of characters. There's nothing enormously exciting in demultiplexing these routines. It's unfortunate that IDL-driven programming exposes a whole bunch of gore at the place where the interface gets demultiplexed. The bulk of the burden ends up on the service implementer rather than on the caller, but almost every program implements some service, even if it's only the destroy interface. Okay, so then you can see the initialized code that I sort of showed you. I would suggest if you're writing your own initialized code, borrow the idiom that's used in the test program, not here. This needs to be converted. The test program idiom is better because it actually tells you what went wrong. So I've repeatedly failed to start the... Oh, I promised to show you CoiQueeman. Let me show you that. Okay. What does it do? Well, based on the directory you're in, it figures out where the top of your build tree is. If it can't, it complains. It then goes looking for a grub disk image. I have the habit that I keep one around in my home directory. It then figures out where your kernel binary would be if you had one built. It figures this out by incestuous knowledge. It makes a copy of that kernel, stripping debugging information out of it, because there's no point copying debugging information onto the floppy that we're going to boot. We can get that from the original file. And it then copies the stripped binary onto the grub disk. And it does the same thing with makeImage.out. So the invocation of this is CoiQueemu, and you tell it the makeImage file. It copies that onto grub disk. It does sync because I don't entirely trust the Linux buffer manager. I don't trust it because I have bitter experience with it. And then it has a bit of hair, which frankly, you probably don't care about. And the nature of this hair is to get the debugger fired up and to install the debugger long enough for Queemu to make enough progress that you can set a breakpoint in the right place. You may want to run the debugger. If you want to run the debugger, that's great. And I will make this script available, and I will even update it so that it will automatically pull in a GDB script so you can print the message buffer in GDB. So one of the tools that we have is a little GDB procedure that knows where to go looking in the kernel to get the log buffer out of the kernel data structure so that it's then printed to GDB. In effect, we've added a GDB command to do that. And you saw me basically say continue a couple of times in the image RAM. Hopefully your images will all run the first time too. I can assure you mine do not. But that's it. One could equally well use the VFAT mount loopback mount mechanism. In fact, the old version of CoiQueemu did. In fact, let me show you, just so you have it. Not only did it, but I still have the mount command available. Okay, and here's the grub.conf file. Which basically says, look, we're gonna boot a kernel called /Kyotos. We're gonna hand it a module called makeImage.out. We've already walked through the module processing code. That's the whole of it, right? That's how the thing gets running. And I will unmount this, okay. Because I used this script, I can never quite remember what's the silly incantation to Queemu to tell it the floppy drive. /FDA? So this time I'm running it without the debugger, right? Once those things are copied onto the floppy image, you simply use the floppy image. If you want a floppy image of your own to mangle, love, and hate, there's one down in Arch i386 tests that's actually used as sort of the prototypical floppy image that gets mangled for all of the test cases. So, you know, one strategy, I'll post the script to the list, and just, you know, grab a copy of that grub disk and stick it in your home directory, and the script will just work. For that matter, I can modify the script to try to grab it out of the tree, which is probably what I ought to do. So that's essentially how you get one of these things running for testing purposes. Okay. Now, I talked about the assignment, and it started to get out of hand, and I asked if you wanted a simpler one, and the answer came back, oh, yes. So we came up with one. Getting what you ask for is, I've added to the tree, where is it? UIDL file IO stream. Okay? ISDream is not exactly exciting, and I'm going to have to add a library routine or two to support it, which I haven't yet had a chance to do, but I will do that in the next 2 days. I should explain what that's about. So this is at least a very early cut and implementing a read-write stream. And I want to go back to something I got wrong last week. Remember I said that you could have multiple endpoints that basically named the same process. But then the problem was you would need a process that would never receive in order for things to block correctly. That's wrong. Not that bad. It turns out that if the receiver slot of the endpoint is set to the null capability, then anybody attempting to invoke that endpoint will block on the endpoint itself. So you can control the on-off behavior of a channel by flipping back and forth between the null capability and the process capability of the process that should be received. It's simpler than I made it out to be. So what I want to do for the first round of this, and I will send a description out to the list, is basically get you to implement a process. I hesitate to say use Text Console as a model. I would say use Text Console as a model, ignoring some of the complexities of its initialize routine, because you're not going to need a physical memory routine for this. And what yours should do as a first step is implement the equivalent to dev null. Dev null is the device that whatever you say to it, read or write, it says, okay, you asked it for an umpteen byte read and it returns 0 bytes. If you feel really inspired, try to do dev zero also. You'll find there's like 2 lines of difference between dev zero and dev null. Now, let me explain what's going on here though. Because remember I said that there were 2 ways that you could choose to implement this. One is to say, every stream is going to involve 3 endpoints, and the caller has to hold all 3 of them. The other is to say, well, actually, we can play some games so the caller doesn't have to do that. And we can basically say, when we would block you, we will ask you to call back on this other channel, and we'll unblock and enable that channel, enable and disable that channel according to where our blocking has to be. So this ISDream IDL interface is the second strategy. Here's what's supposed to happen. But you're not going to actually have to do this when you implement dev null, or at least the null string. The general idea is, okay, let me look at read. I stuck that in the wrong place, bothering. One of the things that you can say in capital is, here's a method that's not really a method. I wanted it declared here because it's logically part of the interface, but it's not really an IDL stub. It's something I'm going to implement in a library that is associated with this interface. In this case, the read and write calls are actually library routines. That's the piece I haven't had a chance to implement. What they're going to do, because you as a client, right, you want to call read and write and not have to worry about the details of this, oh, please, would you go block yourself stuff. What the read routine is going to do internally is it's going to call do read. Ideally, do read is going to proceed just fine, and the read routine will simply return the result. Another possibility is, so do read is the actual cross-process method here. Another possibility is that the implementer of the stream will come back and say, look, I can't handle any more read requests right now. Please go block yourself. The way they do that is by responding with the request would block exception. Whereupon, the read library routine will say, I've been told to block myself. Let me go obtain the read channel. Okay, so the idea is, under the normal situation, requests are going to the generic endpoint. You get back a would block exception, basically go back to the generic endpoint and say, okay, tell me your read endpoint, and I will reissue the request on the read endpoint. At which point I will block over there or not, as the implementer chooses. So under the normal circumstance, all requests are coming in on the same endpoint, and in the unlikely case that the stream actually gets constipated, we push the caller back and tell them to go someplace where we can block them. Assuming the back cover in your eye, bad metaphor, I think. Okay, now notice dev null never blocks. It is very quick to ignore an arbitrarily large number of bytes. I have actually yet to see read queuing happen in dev null, or for that matter in dev zero. So, the first part of this assignment is to implement a server that implements the null string. What that basically means is there's some endpoints allocated for the individual streams. I've drawn three, but the current interface only requires two. The third would be for control operations if we have it. You're going to need to write an initialize routine that buys two more endpoints from your space bank, populates those endpoints with appropriate endpoint IDs and protected payload values, wires them up to point to this process. Why do you have to build these for dev null? Well, you don't. But the dev null has to implement get read channel and get write channel. And in the special case of dev null, where there's never going to be any blocking on any operation, one viable way to respond to get read channel is to simply hand back the original generic endpoint because nothing's going to block. The whole reason to have a read channel is to implement the blocking that we don't have to do. Well, actually, let me revise this. Let me suggest that the first step should be not to fiddle with any extra endpoints. Just get the method dispatch done for the four methods that you actually have to do. Implement dev null. Get a process running that does that. I will build a test case that does read and write calls. The next one I'll ask you to do is dev zero, which is marginally more complicated. The goal for this week is to just get a handle on how to build a process, how to set up an MKI file, how to actually get a process running, how to drive it from a test case. This week, I'm just going to implement a pipe to foreshadow what's coming. A pipe is a process with two streams attached, a buffer. Interesting part about a pipe, unidirectional pipe, by the way. Interesting part about a pipe is that it has to keep track of high and low watermarks in the buffer, and it's got a producer and a consumer, right? The good news is you always have a mutual exclusion because your process only handles one request at a time. But you may have to hold some capabilities to reply because pipes can block. Might suggest as a toy implementation, start by doing only the input half of the pipe and let it block, but this is for the purpose of testing your ability to block a writer, or conversely, testing your ability to block a reader, and then implement the other side of the pipe, right? So fill up the pipe and then, you know, implement the drain logic. Hopefully we break it down into these pieces, this won't be too horrible. But in the meantime, that will give me enough time to actually go look at the serial chip stuff and try to figure out if that's just irrationally too hard to deal with. Hopefully not too bad. I'm pretty confident that if we can use this single thread implementation, it won't be too bad. So I will get that written up and sent to the list, but that's basically the assignment for next week, project assignment. So with that having been said, do people want to dig back into Text Console with the intent of asking questions while I'm here? You notice Mr. Dory is not here. He's unfortunately feeling sick today. So, yeah. Yes? Are there more copies of Text Console floating around? What's that?
It's going to get added.
I still can't hear you. Added, is what
going to be in Mercurial?
Is what going to get added?
Text Console.
Text Console is in Mercurial now.
And
Diastream stuff is in Mercurial. I'm displaying it from a Mercurial workspace as of about 1 o'clock. Excuse me. It is committed, it's not pushed to the public repository because this machine doesn't have a Hopkins network ID. It will be pushed when I get home. My apologies. If people want, is it quick to do the wireless sign up for Hopkins, assuming
yeah.
I have my JET ID? So I'm willing to give it.
If you connect to JHTSnet, you just have to get the other.
That would assume that my wireless driver was working, which on this machine I'm not convinced it is. So let me not waste your time on it. I'll get it pushed when I get home. Set? Assuming I had wireless, there would be many things that I could do. Perhaps. Certainly on good days. All right, so I have to implement the library server. If you want to implement a library stub routine for testing purposes, for dev null, your read operation can simply be a very thin wrapper around do read. In fact, I would recommend that you do that just because I'm going to be traveling for the next 2 days, and that way I won't hold you up. And since dev null and dev zero do not actually ever have to block, there's no reason to do the complicated wrapper. Questions about any of this? I think what you're asking is there a file system yet? The answer is no. We have directory and file logic in Eros that hasn't yet come over. It's pretty clear what we want to do with it. It's not there yet. Most of our near-term applications don't need a file system. It might be, I'll go look at it. It might be the case that implementing a simple file object might be a simpler one to do than implementing def null. Well, what's missing in the IO stream interface, of course, is going to be the seek interface, right? We have to add that, but that's not that big a deal. So we could do that. The idiom for that in Eros Archaeotis is a little different from the way it works in Unix. At least in this sort of simple-minded view of the world, the way you implement a file is by running a process. And that process implements the file, the stream protocol for the file content. And that turns out to have fairly high overhead, so you very quickly go to a scheme where you have one process that implements a bunch of different file objects. But that initial simple implementation is probably the right place to start. Notice there's nothing there to do with naming at all, right? So the model for naming is essentially that you have one process that implements a namespace, and it's essentially a mapping from strings to capabilities. And if you want, for reasons of convenience, to implement something where slashes are separators, fine. There is an issue there with what does the current working directory mean, and that's an interesting can of worms. It's also a can of worms in Unix, right? If I do, in particular, directories and symlinks, right? There's a question, is the symlink applied to the containing, if the symlink is a relative path, is it relative to the containing directory? Or is it relative to the shell's current working directory? Relative to the containing directory, what happens when it crosses a mount point upwards and then comes back down? There's a semantics problem that a mount is a downward relationship, not an upward relationship. The same file system can be mounted in several places. So if it's ambiguous, what dot dot means across a mount point, now what do I do? And the answer is, well, nasty you, you shouldn't have put dot dot, you shouldn't have done symbolic links across the mount point that was not unique. Yeah, that helps me a lot after I'm stuck. I may have actually needed to do that. It's a definitional issue. And there's actually been a small holy war on this, right? I mean, the kernel, after all, does keep a string that is my present working directory. And in principle, it's in a position to implement dot dot with respect to that path, which is always well-defined, but does not always yield the same result as it would have if I'd gone down the mount point. I mean, there, you can construct cases in which you get different answers. These cases don't arise in practice, which is why we get away with it. But okay, other questions on this stuff, though? There's the sense of silent dread. I can't tell you how happy that makes me. Only because it doesn't. Well, there was a piece of code I wanted to walk through. I don't know that I have time to do it in the time we have left. Maybe I'll try anyway. But I really want to give people a chance to ask questions. Make image. So one of the deficiencies in the tree is that the MKI files are not well documented. Let me see if I can give you some clues for decoding those things. Okay, general pattern of a makeimage command line or a capital command line. You'll see a bunch of dash I's. Okay, these are kind of like setting up include directories in the C preprocessor. When makeimage is attempting to resolve module locations, also when capital is attempting to resolve interface locations, it basically substitutes slashes for dots. It appends a file extension, okay, and then it concatenates the resulting path with each of the things that you provided in dash I. The intent is that no MKI file should resolve successfully in more than one location. It's an error. It's an error that's outside of the scope of the tool to be able to check if that should happen. So if you're trying to trace down what happened, and you're looking at an MKI file and you're trying to figure out where it got stuff from, go back and look at the makeimage command and search those other directories. And the good news is you'll find some path down there somewhere corresponding to the thing that got imported, and you can go see what it does. The faster way to do this, since it turns out that all the module names so far are unique, is to simply run find from Kyoto source. Take the module name, slap a .mki on it, and run find looking for that file. And that'll tend to find it pretty quickly. formerly for .idl files. And you may have to wade through some of this stuff, and you may have to actually go back and look at the manual specification pages for things like Spaceman. The one regret I have is that the MakeImage modules are not yet well documented as to what they're doing. There's some documentation in there, but not a whole lot. MakeImage and Capital Syntax are both close enough to C that C mode will help you if you're an Emacs user. It's not entirely by accident. Probably enough on that. I mean, you will have more questions as you come to wrestle with this. Hopefully Scott will be well enough to help, and I will do my best to answer email. Okay. So in currentprocess.c, there is a procedure called proc syscall, which is where all the system calls get dispatched. All the system calls in Kyotos have a control word. Control word has a field that says which system call you're invoking. It has a bunch of other bits whose interpretation depends on the particular system call. Okay, there's a dispatch here. At the moment, there are only three system calls. It used to be five. One is yield, does what it sounds like. The second is copy cap. It's basically allows you to move capabilities back and forth between registers and memory. And the third is invoke cap, which basically calls, surprise, proc invoke cap. Very exciting. I want to attempt to walk through part of it. So at this point, the situation is we have a process running, and it is called back into the kernel. Trying to invoke a capability. There are two cases, and it turns out they're used with almost equal frequency. One is it's doing a cross-process invocation, and the other is it's doing a kernel invocation. And the two cases are actually quite different, unfortunately. So very early, one of the problems with a multiprocessor kernel is that there are things that are in per CPU state that are expensive to get. So you tend to fetch them a lot into local variables on your stack. So we want to get the current process pointer. And then we want to get the invocation control word because we're immediately going to start decoding this system call. At the IDL level, different system calls have different payloads. At the transport level, there's some amount of canonicalization. So you may have a method that only asks for one capability argument. At the transport level, up to four may be passed. You may have a method that only calls for two words worth of argument payload to be sent. The transport layer calls for eight, up to eight. Issues like this. So there's some difference of what things look like at this level versus what things look like at the IDL level. Okay, so what are we going to do? IDL stub generated structure that we call a parameter block. So the parameter block ends up having fields for every input argument and fields where the output arguments are going to go. In the case of capabilities, the output argument fields are saying the locations where we're going to put those capabilities. The first thing we need to know, that parameter block that you passed in wasn't in a piece of memory that you actually have legal access to. A malicious process could pass us a pointer that falls within the kernel region. And by doing so, by knowing what bits were where in the kernel region, could attempt to get the kernel to do something unusual. So we basically have to bounce check the region and make sure that everything in it is well defined. But we're going to declare a fault. Okay. We need to determine. There are these things called soft parameters. So there's a problem on the x86. This problem arises only on the x86. But you don't have enough registers to put all of the parameters in registers. In particular, there are some values that you're going to need later when you're doing the receive that we need to save. Because we're going to need those values later, but between now and then, they're probably going to block. So you need to save them into your process state. So these are called the soft parameters. If you're planning to do either a send phase or a receive phase, we need to grab these parameters. These parameters are being provided on the stack. We'd like to treat them as if they were provided in pseudo registers, so we have to copy them in. Now we're going to basically start building inside the kernel something called an INV param structure. This is the kernel's version of the invocation parameter block. A little different from the external version because the kernel does not have a universal union for all of the methods. The structure, that union, the grand union, gets mapped onto registers and a string. So re-extracts the argument from those registers and strings. So it has a different point of view on what the payload looks like. Also, the INV for M structure includes some other fields that are of relevance only to the kernel. Which process is doing the invocation? Which process are we returning to? That may or may not be the same process that is doing the invocation. And we're starting to initialize that here. Invocation has, in general, conceptually, has three phases. It has a send phase, it has a receive phase, and it has a copyout phase. Copyout phase exists to deal with register deficiencies. There are incoming parameters like endpoint ID and protected payload that on many architectures we just don't have enough outgoing registers to get them all out. So we need to copy them back up to the receiver stack. Copyout phase is what does that. The problem here is we don't want a page fault there. So the actual copy on x86 is that those values go to a reserved area in the process structure, and the invocation is then considered from the caller perspective, or even from the receiver perspective, the invocation is complete, but there's still this copyout phase that has to run. So what's really happening here is there are actually three system calls, send, receive, and copyout, that are being boxcarred in a single kernel invocation where we can. Make sense what the copyout phase is going to be doing? Probably not. Go ahead with the send phase, at least a little bit. We're not going to get very far on this. Okay, IPW0SP, right? This is the bit that says, we're doing the send phase. It's actually possible to do a capability invocation which has no send phase, no receive phase, and no copyout phase. Why you would do that is not immediately clear to me, but it's possible to do it. All right, so if we're doing a send phase, that's the part where we're invoking the capability. What the kernel has to do is figure out what capability you're going to invoke. This is a source capability, it's not a destination capability, so we're basically going to say, for each of the argument capabilities that you're sending, getting ahead of myself. Up here. Let me marshal the capability that's being invoked. What you provided in the invocation parameter block was the location of that capability. The kernel needs to get the actual capability bits. That's what this marshaling step is doing. A lot of things could happen in the marshaling. But this is potentially doing a memory reference. That may cause a page fault. Cause an invalid address. The faults that are associated with input argument marshaling, if any, logically happen before the system call. So if you're sending a string and there's a page fault in the middle of the string, that page fault conceptually happens at the beginning of the system call before any data is transferred. Of course, we cheat. But if you page fault on the incoming arguments, the kernel will essentially back out, take the page fault as if it had happened just before the system call, and when the page fault completes, the system call will be restarted from the beginning. The anonymity thing is important. It allows us to do things like that. If you are sending capabilities, it might be convenient to know where they're coming from. So marshal those as well. And if you sent two, okay, here's an interesting question. I send two capabilities, you're expecting three. What should happen? If I use the stub generator, this should not arise in practice. But should not and does not are two different statements. And the kernel has to behave correctly in the face of hand-coded calls, which might be wrong. So what should happen if you send two and I'm expecting three? It should fail. It's a malformed request. Okay. IBM technology rep, okay, is that it? IBM marketing person. At a conference, question and answer session comes up. He's asked, what's the value of pi? Possible answers are 3, you know, 3.14 or something. I don't know, and I'll get back to you. What is the answer? I'll get back to you. Why? No. But first, you got to understand that no IBM marketing person is allowed to say, I don't know at any time. So that rules that out. Okay. The correct answer is 3.14 something. Unfortunately, there's a recent research paper from IBM claiming that the correct answer is 3. It's not politically correct to contradict your fellow colleagues at IBM, so the only remaining choice is I'll get back to you. You know, the sad thing about this joke is this really is how IBM marketing people work. Okay. So what about if I send you 3 and you're expecting 2? Request is still malformed. But this is actually a little tricky because if I'm invoking a kernel capability, later in this path, I'll get to a point where I can recognize that the request is malformed. If I'm invoking cross-process, I simply have to move the bits and hope for the best, because the sanity check, I don't know what the protocol is, so the sanity check has to be done by the receiver. So there is a subtle difference there. For this reason, I have to marshal all of the capabilities that you alleged you were going to send, whether I give a damn or not. I don't yet know if I give a damn. Okay. The protocol says, and as part of a send, you can generate a reply capability. That's the entry capability that the other guy's going to use to reply back to you. And in order to generate a reply capability, I need to know that my reply endpoint is in memory. And I need to know that it's locked. Because I'm about to manipulate it, and I don't want it destroyed while I'm manipulating it. The way I do that is I prepare the capability to it. So the protocol is, if you want a reply capability generated, you supply the endpoint capability in the first capability argument position, and the kernel in the path will say, oh, if that's an endpoint, I will replace it on the way through with an entry capability that's going to be used to reply. So if we've been told to generate a reply capability, we're setting up to do that. We make sure the endpoint is valid and we lock it. Inside these marshals, by the way, were also calls to prepare. I take that back. Okay. Notice the call to get send cap versus get invoke cap. I'm thinking this might actually be a bug. Okay, here's the concern. I think get invoke cap is doing the right thing. So here's the concern. The capability that we're going to invoke, we better prepare it because we have to know the destination process actually exists. Better lock it down. The capabilities that we're passing, as long as they're not going to be consumed by the kernel, we don't really care. They can be just as bad on the receive side as they are on the send side. That's okay. Because that will look as if null capabilities got passed, and that's fine. Okay, so if we're going to do a reply, yeah, so what's happening here is get send cap does not force a cap repair, and so we have to do it here if we're generating a reply capability. I think if we were to dig in, we would discover that get invoke cap actually does a deeper check that makes sure that the target is alive. Okay, now, we're being asked to fabricate an endpoint capability, an entry capability for the reply. We can only do that if we were handed an endpoint capability, and if we did, we're actually going to replace the argument capability here. We've already copied this argument capability at this point. We're going to replace it with an entry capability, and we're going to proceed on that. And interesting problem, for cases and protocols. Suppose that there are actually two. I'm going to match later. I'm going to wait for a reply. There are a variety of ways that I could get stuck in which it would matter exactly when in the sequence the entry capability got. Because if I say I want to do payload matching, then the protected payload field is going to move out from under me. I've got to be matching the right protected payload fields. The specification actually has to say what's the order of operation here in order to get a sense of locker. Flexible does not mean the outcome you want. Flexible means an outcome that can be used correctly without undue overhead, and that if used incorrectly may yield surprising results. Raw low-level system call interface. And a lot of the solution to problems of that nature is to make sure that the specification allows you to ignore them without being caught up in a contract violation. Okay, so we bump the protected payload. If you're sending a string, we better make sure you have it. And then it falls within the legal range of application addresses. If you're later going to receive a string, you have to at least check if you've got the bounds correct. In this case, we're doing the bounds check. Because we've got to make sure this invocation is well formed. If you're doing a receive bound check, we need to make sure that all the locations you're planning to receive to constitute valid addresses. The problem here is conceptually we are probing those addresses before the exercise even starts. The goal is to make sure that the receive string is valid. That might be in your heap, it might be a page for which no backing exists yet.
All right, SLAN. SLAN is non-zero exactly if you are sending a string. If you're sending a string, we had to validate those too. And here we get to the first sort of interesting part of this, right? So far we're just doing argument checking.
The only thing to do argument checking is a cardinal sin.
Okay. I'm gonna stop here, but I'm gonna tell you what's going on in CAP prepare for invocation. So there are two kinds of capabilities we might be invoking.
Invoking an entry capability, in which case we're doing cross-process, assuming the entry capability is valid. Or invoking a kernel capability.
CAP
prepare for invocation, if we're invoking a kernel capability, is going to return zero. There's no possible error case here. I don't know what capability we're invoking, but we're invoking some capability. The only question is it the entry case? And so if it is the entry case, cat prepare for invocation is going to do a fair amount of work. It's going to prepare the entry capability. It's going to lock the endpoint. It's going to check the payload match bits because the invocation protocol requires that if we've set the appropriate mode bit. It's going to reach in and get the receiver capability. If receiver capability is null, and we're willing to block, it's going to enqueue us on that endpoint, and that'll be the end of this story. If receiver capability is a process capability, it's going to prepare it to force the process into memory. It's going to grab a lock on the target process, because we're about to diddle the state of the target process. It would be inconvenient if that process were dispatched to run at this moment. See, there's a bunch of setup happening. The way we're going to know in the main path which path we're going down is whether we get back an endpoint pointer. There's an entry capability, there's an endpoint, that's how we know. And the reason these two cases are a little different, if I invoke an entry capability, I have to set up a reply, but the reply is not gonna happen here. The reply is gonna happen much later when some other process responds to me. The case where I'm invoking an entry capability is I'm copying payload from one process to another. I'm enqueuing the sender. I'm starting the receiver running. Or possibly the receiver isn't ready, and I'm going to enqueue the sender until the receiver is ready. So, contrast this with, and I'm going to pass to the receiver the reply capability, and the receiver will later invoke to reply. Contrast to that, it could be the kernel case. Kernel case, the almost universal pattern is going to be the reply capability points back to myself. We hope that's true. I'm going to go off and invoke a kernel method. It's going to do argument checking. It may at that point declare a failure. The kernel method is going to complete, and it's going to behave as if we're invoking the reply capability. Fortunately, there are some corner cases there. But the good news is, if I'm invoking you, the one thing to know is this invocation will not cause you to cease to exist. That's the new existentialist kernel development. Unfortunately, if the capability I'm invoking is the range capability, it could very well be that I am destroying the process which has also been named as the returnee from this invocation. Or that you'll see in the code is invokee. So there's a real possibility that there are a few operations, not many, which can cause an invokee that at this point looks to be kosher to cease to be valid by the time we're actually returning the return result. There is some good news. Now, the good news is that none of those methods return any non-register payload. Be careful about that. The reason is, it allows us to basically say, okay, we will hold a very small staging area for returned register arguments. You don't just copy them out to the receiver. Partly because if the receiver is also the sender, you don't want to overwrite arguments before you're even using them. Right? So you actually probably want a staging buffer anyway. Then at the very last instant, we're going to check if the receiver continues to exist. If the receiver no longer exists, or if the path to the receiver is not valid, we're simply going to drop the response on the floor. And the protocol definition is, the kernel responds as if by a non-blocking send. And all of the conditions under which the receiver would no longer be valid, it would have to block. We've not agreed to block, so we move on and the send is dropped. That's what it means to do a non-blocking send. So you can see that there are corner cases in the kernel invocation case that have to be checked, a variety of awkward conditions that have to be tested on the way out that we would prefer not to pay for in the cross-process case. That's why there's an early decision here about whether we're doing the entry capability. The kernel doesn't know what the argument structure is from the entry capability. Only the receiver knows that. So there's a very strong split early on. Very early papers on capability systems introduced the term extensible capability system. Extensible means an application can implement a capability that you then invoke just like it was any other capability. Well, somewhere down on the ground, somebody has to be in on the joke that you're doing the extension case. This is where it happens. I want to come back to this, and I'm going to go through this with some care next week. And at that point, believe it or not, when we're done going through this, we will have seen essentially all of the kernel code there is to see. It fits down in the object store that we won't have visited. But believe it or not, we're approximately done. Go on to play with application level stuff. I said at the beginning that the goal was to sort of walk through the kernel startup and then walk through the vacation. That's what we're about to do. The rest is all handled in application code. Talk about one or two of those, but we're very close to the end of the kernel path. Desperately holding on until we got to the end. Okay, questions about this before we go? Okay, IOU, no. Those two library implementations for read and write, just do calls to do read and do write. You can do this for yourselves. I don't want to be in your way. IOU and assignment description sent to the mailing list. What else do I owe you this time? Sorry?
You need to push IOStream.
I need to push IOStream when I get home. Thank you. Thank you.